You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host today. I'm Jessica and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai aki nei coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, Dr. Kushla McGovern will be chatting about the human brain, coral reef biodiversity and scorpions. Stay tuned for that first up. MP James Meagher is taking over from Dr. Shane Ritty for our weekly catch-up with the National Party. This week I speak to James about the government removing the Auckland regional fuel tax, as well as funding for pre-sentencing cultural reports. I also chat to Action Against Poverty coordinator about cultural reports. Sophia speaks to head farmer at OMG Farm, Jake Clark, about the impact of Western farming practices on soil fertility. And she speaks to senior transport planner at Arup, a collective of engineers and consultants, Tiffany Robinson, about urban design and indigenous wisdom. He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395 or waia mai rane, give me a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka owe e wariwari, e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki eni, kororo, anohi, pakihiri, roki roki maurunga, e te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho, mihari ki 95BFM edakati.com. And catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We're joined in the studio with Dr. Kushla McGovern. Kia ora, Kushla.
Kia ora.
How are you today?
Great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
That's good to hear. So this is your first Dear Science, solo Dear Science. Would you mind just quickly introducing yourself a bit for our listeners?
Right, so I'm what's called a Senior Research Fellow in the Department of Physics here at University of Auckland. So that basically means I research rather than lecture. And I'm actually a chemist by training, so I kind of hide out in the physics department. And as you'll see today, most of the science stories that excited me over the past week actually have a biological bend to them. So I don't stick to one discipline at all.
Right, so kind of like a Russian spy of chemistry almost. All right, well, first up, I wanted to ask you about scientists who have been 3D printing tissue that has some of the functionality of human brain tissue. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Yes, this is really exciting, right? Like, we all know the brain is a really complex organ, and for us to understand and develop new drugs and understand disease, we really need to understand it on the cellular level, and that's really hard. Like, if we use animal models, they're not exactly the same as us, obviously, and there's a lot of ethical considerations. So there's been a lot of work about developing models in the lab that you can use to study processes. And so what happened over the last sort of week, a paper was published where they basically made a gel that they could seed with stem cells and then 3D print. And while this is really amazing is because brain is soft tissue, it's really hard to have a gel that you can kind of print that it's not too stiff, but it's stiff enough that it maintains some structure. And so that's where they have been really smart with the mixture that they've made. And then basically, you know, if you know a 3D printer where you've got your filament that's plastic, instead of doing that, they've got this jelly mush that can be extruded through a needle and prints this really thin layer, like 50 microns, which is less than kind of the average human hair thickness. And then they're basically putting this gel that's got these stem cells in into a bath that's got some nutrients and some chemicals that are called neurotrophic factors. And what these do is they tell the stem cells, right, you want to go become this, because stem cells are undifferentiated. They haven't chosen what they're going to do in life yet. And so by doing this, what they were able to produce is this tissue that had neuronal and glial cells, which are the two main types of cells in your brain. But what's even better is that they actually formed a network, which is what happens in your brain. You have these network of cells that communicate with each other, and that's why we can do stuff. And so they were able to show this. And so that has really exciting implications down the line.
Yeah, so what are some of those implications for the field?
So that's like things, like if you think about development of new pharmaceuticals to treat neuro diseases and things, you don't want to test it on people straight off. You don't necessarily want to use the animals to test. So you can start to do some of this initial testing on these sorts of models in the lab. And so you can start to identify what are the good sort of molecular candidates for as new drugs and what aren't. And then you can also, like, this is still a model, it's still in development, obviously, but as time goes along and they research more and better develop it, you can probably start to doing like disease models and stuff like this as well.
That is really fascinating. I was also wondering, so there's something else going on with researchers are using satellite imaging to estimate coral reef biodiversity. What does this mean for those of us who don't know a lot about this area?
Cool. So biodiversity is just, it's a way of describing how many different types of species of plants and animals are in an area. And so it's really important because the more biodiverse an area is, the more likely it is to handle stress like climate change, right? So we know that we have an extinction problem globally. Humans have been pretty rough on the ecosystems. And so it's really important for us to understand the biodiversity we have in various parts of the planet now. What you typically do to figure out biodiversity is you have to go out into the field and count. Like you count how many fish, you count how many different corals. And if you're doing this underwater, you need scuba divers. And it's really takes a lot of time, is really costly. So what could you do otherwise? Like how? What's another way that we could potentially measure this biodiversity? We have a lot of satellites around the planet. Can we use this remote sensing? And so that's what they've done. They've basically taken data from various satellites and they've determined the different habitats in an area. So is it rocky? Is it coral? Is it onshore? Is it deeper water? And they've determined how different in an area, how many different sorts of habitats do you have? And then the more different habitats you have, the more likely you are to have more different species, because they've each got species kind of tend to, they develop a niche where they live, right? They like this area, so they'll kind of procreate and this population will grow in that area. And so that's what they're doing. So they're not using the satellite images to count all the different animals. They're using it to determine what's the topography like, what's the land like, if it's terrestrial, what's the underwater area like, and then using how much that changes to give a measure of how many different species you might have.
And speaking of species, scorpions, what's going on there?
Now, I really love this paper, mainly because of its title, which I'll read out. Hitching a Ride on a Scorpion, the First Record of Ferocity of a Myrmecophile Pseudoscorpion on a Myrmecophile Scorpion. And it's, scorpions are cool. They're scary, but they're cool. Because they're fluorescent. So if you wave a UV light over a scorpion, it glows green and blue. And that's really cool. And it's basically because they've got these molecules in their cuticle, in the outer layer, that fluoresces. And so there was this researcher who was out following ant trails to find scorpions, because the scorpion that he was looking for, it uses the ant trails to get back to the ant nest, and it goes into the ant nest and it lives in there because it likes eating the ant larvae. And the ants seemed to let it in, which is a bit weird. But what he noticed was that there were some black spots on the scorpion, and he's like, what are they? And then it's taken them 5 years to figure this out, but there's these little things called pseudoscorpions, and that's what was sitting on the scorpion. And it's basically, a pseudoscorpion is much smaller. It's about, averages about 3 millimeters. It's got the pincers of a scorpion, it's got the 8 legs, but it doesn't have the tail, and it's not fluorescent. And what they think is happening is that these pseudoscorpions basically hitch a ride on the scorpion to get into the ant nest so that once they're in the ant nest, they can go eat the mites and the small prey that are hanging out in the ant nest, because it turns out ant nests are like a buffet for other animals. So, yeah.
Interesting. I feel like I can see the Pixar movie already.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Kushla. And thank you to MoTat. And thank you, Science. We'll see you in 2 weeks, Kushla.
See you in 2 weeks.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MoTat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Saturday, March 23rd. I ride a star. Off the back of a world tour, Melbourne's Alicia Joy debuts Tamaki Makaurau with her unique mix of new jazz and soul. Alicia Joy with Hudge and Christoph El Chirento in support at Neck of the Woods, Saturday, March 23rd. Get your tickets from ticketfairy.com.
Love is in the air at MoTat for Pride Comedy Night on Valentine's Day, February 14th.
Let your heart soar in the Aviation Hall as you enjoy lots of laughs with whatever cutie you choose. And a night of comedy hosted by Tom Sainsbury.
Featuring an amazing lineup of Kiwi comedians, including Abby Howells, David Stewart and Brinley Stent.
Tickets are limited, so get in quick.
Pride Comedy Night, February 14th, 6:30 p.m. Get your tickets at motat.nz.
Audio Culture.
Tune in to 95BFM Drive every second Tuesday as they're joined by one of our friends from Audio Culture, sharing the songs, stories and salacious scandal from which is woven the mighty tapestry of New Zealand music.
Audio Culture, more cultured than a blue cheese with a BA. Every other Tuesday on 95BFM Drive.
Thanks to Audio Culture. Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with National Party MP James Mega.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Last week, the government announced it would be removing funding for the cultural background reports used in sentencing, as well as the Auckland Regional Fuel Tax. For our weekly catch-up with National, I spoke to MP James Mega about these announcements. I also asked Mega about his background in politics, as this is our first interview with him. Here is that interview. Since this is your first interview with 95BFM, can you tell our listeners a bit about yourself and your political career so far?
Yeah, sure, thanks. So I'm the MP for Rangitata, which is an electorate down in mid-south Canterbury. So it basically runs from Rakaia River down to the Rangitata River, then takes in a sliver of South Canterbury, including Timaru, Timaru and Pleasant Point. So that's where I grew up, down in South Canterbury. I've got a public law background, so I was a litigation lawyer at Simpson Grierson for a few years, and actually worked in Parliament before that. So I worked as a press secretary for Paula Bennett for a year, and also in opposition under Bill English and Simon Ridges.
What are your main goals as an MP?
I think the number one goal for me, especially as a backbench MP and an electorate backbench MP, is just to make sure that I represent the views and concerns of my constituents in Parliament. So whenever I'm in Wellington in Parliament, that's my number one goal, is making sure that issues that are important to people in Mid-South Canterbury are aired up here in Wellington, and I do my job as a legislator. And also, one goal of mine is to make sure we get through our busy workload on the Justice Committee. So I'm chairing the Justice Committee, and I'm really keen to make that committee as collegial a workspace as possible. So I think they're the two really key things that I'm interested in this term. The other one would be, of course, it'd be great to get a members bill drawn from the ballot. I've got a lot of good ideas, but sometimes that's just the luck of the draw. So that's a goal, but by no means something that I can guarantee.
So the government announced that it would be scrapping the Auckland Regional Fuel Tax. Can you tell us about what considerations went into this decision?
Yeah, so I'm wary of wading into this because I'm not an Aucklander. And so we didn't get faced with the regional fuel tax down in South Canterbury. And I know that Aucklanders did, and it was about 11 odd, 11.5 cents a litre on fuel at a time when cost of living was really tough and people were finding it hard to get enough money to spend on their fuel, let alone their groceries and rent. So we just thought that it wasn't the right time for a tax like this, specifically on Auckland. And Minister Simeon Brown has I understand, spoken with the Mayor and Auckland Council a number of times about how they do pay for those core infrastructure projects that are needed in Auckland. And he's going to look at things like congestion charging and legislation to allow the council to have other funding tools. We just think that a tax, an extra tax at this point on those who can least afford it is not the way to go.
The government has highlighted that they want to focus on reducing congestion and increasing productivity, particularly in those high populated cities like Auckland. Would you agree that the fuel tax encouraged more people to use public transport and therefore was able to reduce congestion?
Well, I don't necessarily think so, because all it did was add on cost of petrol at the tank. So, yeah, there might have been some people who reduced their private vehicle usage and went to public transport, but actually a lot of people used their cars to get to places where public transport isn't an option. Like, I know, for instance, the links between South Auckland and the airport, for some of the airport employees aren't particularly good at the moment, and so they wouldn't have had an option of getting out of their private vehicle and getting into public transport. So I think you've got to look at funding tools which accurately reflect the usage of the roads and where people are trying to get to. That's why congestion charging, value capture, tolling, other things like that might be a better way of doing it. So that if you are in your car and you're using it to get to places where you just can't access public transport, you're not penalised for that. Whereas something like congestion charging, when you might be charging people a bit extra to get into town, might actually persuade more people to get into public transport because those routes are available.
Right, so it would essentially be a fuel tax but more targeted towards those who could be using other measures of transport like public transport that would reduce congestion.
Well, it just to be, I guess we'll be clear, it wouldn't be a fuel tax because it wouldn't be charged on fuel. It'd be more similar to how we're looking at road user charging being expanded across the network so that you can more accurately put the cost burden on those who use the roads to contribute to those roads. I think you could call it, I think there's been different words for it, value capture, congestion charging, but the idea is to make sure that it's a lot fairer, because the other thing is that when you have a fuel tax, and especially in Auckland, an additional 11.5 cents, if you have a less fuel efficient vehicle, you'll end up paying more because you use more fuel, more petrol per kilometre than other cars. And the people who tend to use less fuel-efficient vehicles are those at the bottom end, those who can't afford, you know, brand-new hybrids or brand-new trucks or anything like that. So we think there's an equity and a fairness issue involved in here as well, and that's why we're looking to move towards more road user and congestion-type charging than pure fuel taxes.
I also wanted to talk to you about the government scrapping funding for cultural reports as well as the prison population reduction targets that were set by Labor previously. The government has said that its priority is reducing crime. How will this move contribute to that?
Well, let's take them one at a time. So the cultural reports question is an interesting one. So we're going to be a bit clear. The reports themselves aren't being scrapped. It's some of the government funding for the cottage industries that have been set up to run those reports. So what used to happen is... And I know defence lawyers are very busy, but lawyers would put pleas and mitigation into court to put their defendants or their client's best case forward, give some of the context, the background, some of the reasons that might have gone into their offending. So then the court could take that into account when delivering a sentence. Now, that's all perfectly fine, and that is still able to happen. What we want to change is this cottage industry which sprung up, which was essentially you'd go out and you'd contract someone who's never met the client, doesn't know anything about them, to produce a template report outlining a whole bunch of sort of tick box issues to put that before the court. We didn't think that was appropriate. We didn't think it was appropriate for taxpayers to be funding that when some of that money could be better spent on victims of crime. So that's what we decided to do in that space. And then on the second part around the prisoner target, prisoner reduction targets, we support targets in general. We think that the previous government probably didn't use targets enough and didn't measure themselves against what they intended to deliver enough. The one issue with the prisoner reduction target was that it wasn't actually doing anything to keep communities safe. And there was very little going on in terms of what do we do with our men and women when we release them back on the streets in terms of reintegration into society and what rehabilitation programs are available to them in prison. For example, if you're on remand in prison at the moment, you're not able to access any rehabilitation programs because you haven't been sentenced. So that's a real issue. You've got people spending a lot of time in prison, sometimes months and years on remand, who can't actually get the rehabilitation and the help that they need in order to make them productive members of society. So we've thought that we would get rid of those reduction targets. They haven't done anything to reduce the amount of crime. They're not keeping people safe, and they're not actually helping prisoners reintegrate into the system. And we will roll out some changes in that area, which will hopefully see some better outcomes.
So Labor did state last year that they would not implement prisoner reduction targets if re-elected, but they have said that they were needed at the time to prevent overcrowding in prisons. Is this something that you would agree was necessary at the time?
Well, I think the ambition of having fewer people in prisons is a good one. We'd generally want no one in prisons because we don't want any crime happening. But I think the previous Labor government's focus was on the wrong area. I think they were trying to reduce the costs of incarceration and reduce the number of people in prisons just by letting people out and putting no real controls or no rehabilitative programs in place. Our view is that we want to take a social investment approach to all of this, including incarceration. So we want to make sure that we're investing in the bottom end, so before people are getting into prison, to make sure that don't get there in the first place, and that when they do stay there, they're working hard to make themselves more productive and better members of society. But there's another aspect to this, and that is that, you know, there is a place for prisons, and there is an incarceration and a punishment and detention aspect to prisons. When people break the law, commit crimes, essentially assault public decency, the public need to have trust in the justice system that there are consequences for actions. So part of being in prison is detention, is keeping people safe, is punishment for the crime. Gone are the days of an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, but this is the sort of this is the retributive system that we have in place of that. So I'm very comfortable with where we're heading in that system. I'm chairing the Justice Committee, so a lot of these changes will come before me. So I'm wary of getting too far ahead of preempting what's going to come up. And I also want to run a pretty neutral line when I'm chairing the committee so that both sides of the table get a chance to have their say on these issues too. So I am looking forward to the busy workload though.
And I just lastly want to touch on cultural reports. Do you see any benefit in the courts considering someone's background in criminal cases to help understand what may have contributed to them offending?
Yep, absolutely. And I was never a criminal lawyer, but as someone who did a plea and mitigation years ago as part of their law degree, understand the value in a defence lawyer or the court providing or being furnished with information about an offender's background, some of the mitigating factors that led to their offending, some of the reasons why certain kinds of sentences or punishments might not be appropriate, and there could be other ways of doing things. I was up visiting the Drug and Alcohol Court up in Waitakere in January, and I met several of the men who went through that program and are now essentially peer support advocates and caseworkers and have been clean for several years. And that's an example of a system being put in place which treats the actual problem while still ensuring that offenders recognise and account for their offending. So I think that it's perfectly appropriate for that stuff to go before the court, just not in the taxpayer-funded way for that cottage industry that it had been happening previously.
How will the government ensure that access to those cultural reports are equitable, as we know that crime and poverty are intrinsically linked?
Yeah, so there is always going to be access to the cultural reports. You can do them without cost. So whānau members and family members can produce reports and can input into the defence lawyer who can collate this information and present to the court. What's been happening though is it's become highly professionalised, and these industries are being set up where, you know, as I mentioned before, people would write these reports without knowing the offender at all or knowing the defence lawyer's client. So how can that be an accurate reflection on who they are, their background, the mitigating circumstances? So yeah, there are some equity issues there we have to look at. Part of that is the wider justice system and access to justice and the efficiency and speed of the system, time spent on remand, the levels of legal aid and maybe some of the disparities between prosecution and defence funding. So they are all things we need to look at. And actually, if people are interested, next week the Ministry of Justice is before the Justice Committee for a 3-hour in-depth review. So we'll be probably going across a lot of those issues over the 3 hours that they are there. So I would encourage people, if they have some time in the morning, to tune in from, I'd have to say, around about 9 a.m. on the next Thursday, and there'll be a very interesting discussion about all those issues there.
That was National's James Meagher on his goals as a politician, as well as the government announcing it will remove funding for cultural background reports and the Auckland regional fuel tax.
That was our catch-up with National Party MP James Meagher.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
The government's decision to remove funding for pre-sentencing cultural background reports has faced criticism from advocates, particularly for how it could impact Māori and Pacifica disproportionately. I spoke to Action Against Poverty coordinator Brooke Powell-Stanley about their recommendations for how the government could better reduce crime in Aotearoa. Here is that interview. What is your reaction to these announcements?
I mean, I think it's reflective of what this government is trying to achieve in wanting constitutional transformation, and but instead of trying to do that by looking at the impacts of colonial capitalism, they're looking to remove the rights and support and solidarity for tino rangatiratanga and mana motuhake. And I think removing funding for cultural reports is just a detail in that bigger plan that they've got.
How do you see cultural background reports as being beneficial, particularly when it comes to preventing future reoffending?
Well, the establishment of those reports was to try and give judges a wider picture as to the reasons and drivers of offending, was to look at more equitable outcomes specifically for Māori. I think removing that funding means that people who are experiencing poverty especially won't be able to access those reports, which have been, I know, very beneficial. For people that experience poverty, it means that judges won't have context as to the drivers of crime, which is linked to colonial capitalism and colonisation, the impacts of colonisation that people feel today. But the thing is also that these reports can be accessed by anybody, and so it gives a fuller picture as to why people are offending and harming in our communities. And a lot of that actually is to do with the harm that they've received from the state. And so I think we're going to see more people locked up and, you know, just really archaic practices and solutions that are being put forward in ways that further disconnect us from ourselves and our communities. And, you know, we don't get to look at solutions that are grounded in love and care. And we believe that actually the solutions moving forward for all of us are solutions that are grounded in love and care and are about care, not cages.
The government has said that cultural reports have created a cottage industry and is accusing cultural reports of getting criminals softer sentences. Can you speak to what they mean by this and what impact you feel this rhetoric will have on the most vulnerable here in Aotearoa?
I think the government is talking mad shit. I think they don't know what they're talking about. I think it's really obvious that they don't know what's required to help our communities heal. They're not even aware that actually the government is responsible for a lot of the harm that people are experiencing on this whenua. And so, I mean, for me, it's really obvious that we have a really racist government. And I think, to be honest, the establishment of a government itself here on this whenua has already been racist. But when we have one that's visibly attacking and being quite direct and upfront about their intentions, it's a lot easier for us to see. I think much like many of the policies and the impacts of colonisation are often invisible these days, but when we have a government like this one, who's really clear about being racist and bringing those divisive policies and narratives and rhetoric to the forefront of what they're up to, it's easy for us to identify and say, look, this is actually not okay. It hasn't been okay for hundreds of years here. And I think, like, moving forward, I mean, it's quite buzzy to me that they would come into power, make an assessment, or you would think they would make an assessment and an analysis of what's going on, not only on this whenua, but also around the world, and think, oh, yeah, we're going to try and change the treaty principles. We're going to take away all this funding to, like, frontline communities. Like, these are the solutions and vision that they have for Aotearoa. And, I mean, it's like, read the room. Clearly they're not reading the room, and they don't have the courage, the political willpower, or even the values that we need right now from our leaders in a time that everything is shifting and at such a rapid pace. And they just kind of want to leave us like, oh yeah, it's all good, we'll just burn.
You mentioned that you've seen the benefits of cultural reports. Can you speak a bit to the impact that you've seen these have?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, $7 million to assist with 2,500 reports, they're saying that that's too much. That's nothing for the government. That's like $5 to them. I love how they think that taking away $7 million, $7.5 million, that helped produce 2,500 reports last year. I mean, that's the thing, the impact and the power that that has in the communities. They're not seeing that because people are able to get on with their lives. People are going into, you know, trying to heal and pick themselves up. I know personally family members that have accessed those reports and had their sentencing reduced quite significantly. And they've gone on to study. They've gone on to look after family. They've gone on to heal, looking at ways in which they can contribute so that their children don't have to take those same pathways. Like, it's opening up real healing for people from a place of, like, transformation and opportunity and access. And I think, like I mentioned earlier, you take those things away from our communities and what you're doing is further harming them. And that actually has an impact laterally. We then start to harm each other. And I think, like, they're playing with fire. Like, they really are. Not just for taking away this type of funding, looking to reduce funding in other areas that are extremely important, that are already under-resourced. And I think you play with fire, you get burned. So you want to keep going like this, let's see what happens.
The government has affirmed that their priority is reducing crime. What would your recommendations be for how they could better achieve this?
Yeah, for us, we're really clear that if you want to reduce crime in our communities, you need to resource our frontline communities. You need to address the drivers of poverty. We need livable incomes. We need universal services. We need a plan to shift us from this system into one that's grounded in Matike Mai, actually. There is already work that's being done for constitutional transformation, and that work is Matike Mai. It comes with Te Tiriti and He Whakaputanga. These are the founding documents of this country, and we should be honouring those documents and those practices and those ways, because they're grounded in holistic patterns of being and living not only with each other but also the land and the waters. And anything else that isn't going to be real about addressing those things and moving us towards an Aotearoa that looks after all of us is rubbish. We don't want it. And we've been really clear about that.
That was Brooke Powell Stanley discussing action against poverty's recommendations for how the government could reduce crime in Aotearoa.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Keep it on the B.
Scientists have finally found the clitoris.
The Wire.
Just kidding. We're back right now, and we've got a couple more pieces for you. In 2018, Women in Urbanism Aotearoa conducted a survey that found more than 75% of women experienced harassment while using public transport, cycling or walking. The survey is opening again, and this time there is a focus on better understanding Wahine Māori experiences, particularly in a Western transport framework. AREP, a collective organisation of engineers and designers, are heading the research and want to see how urban spaces and transport systems could look like from a te ao Māori perspective. Sophia spoke to senior transport planner at AREP, Tiffany Robinson, about the project and started off by asking Robinson about what it entails.
There are actually two projects that we're running concurrently. So the survey is part of a community engagement project that we're doing with Women in Urbanism Aotearoa. And so that is basically a refresh of a street harassment survey that they did back in 2018. And then we're working, once we get the survey results, we'll be working to visualize those results and give that back to Women in Urbanism so folks can actually see what the results are. And then parallel to that, we have a research project that we're working on through our internal research division called AREP University. And that's where we're working on a project that's really taking a look at this idea of designing mobility and urban spaces by using a te ao Māori approach. We know that the systems that we're in, the transport systems, the public spaces, have generally been formed using a Western planning approach. What if we were to, you know, look at it from a te ao Māori approach? What would that look like in planning and design? So that's kind of the basis of the research. And what we're looking to do is get the lived experience from people who are Māori, both Wahine and Kōtiro, to find out from them, do you feel safe in the spaces that exist around you? Do you feel a sense of belonging in the places that are around you? And how could we approach that a bit differently?
Would you be able to describe in any way how a Western and Māori landscape might differ from each other?
Yeah, so one of the things when we had some conversations, one of the things that came up was Matamataka. So in terms of consultation specifically, using Matamataka to say, is this a good day to actually have a consultation? Is this a day where people, you know, ideas are flowing? Or is there a better day that might actually serve those conversations a bit better? Is there a way to start to incorporate some of the indigenous wisdom that already exists? Use that approach to incorporate in the planning that we're doing. So that's just one example. And really from the lived experience, having those workshops, having the wānanga, is to really identify, are there other opportunities that we might be missing because we just don't live in that world?
For those who don't know, could you explain what a wānanga is?
Yes. So wānanga is essentially a workshop. It's a workshop that is really getting into what's the real deal, stripped down, getting folks around the table, getting real about conversations and having a space that people feel comfortable to do that.
Have you found in the past that there's been a big difference between answers you might get through a survey online compared to an in-person talk?
Oh, absolutely. And I think because when you're doing it online, you have the ability to maintain your anonymity and there's nothing tying you to it. But in person, you really have to be comfortable with the space. You have to feel like the physical space is comfortable to you. You have to feel comfortable with the people that you're providing your information to. So it's really relationship building that's the difference between just an online survey and an in-person survey. And because we're asking, you know, particularly probing questions when it comes to safety and sense of belonging, that's something that we want to handle a little bit more carefully.
What follows the workshop? How do you plan on compiling the conversation into data, essentially?
Yeah, so what we're doing is for the research project, we're actually doing, prior to the workshop, we're doing some literature review because we want to see, is there anything else out there? We know that, you know, there's been other work done. We at Arab have done some research around designing cities that work for women. And then taking the information from the workshops to taking that along with the lit research, putting those together and drawing out essentially just a bit of a white paper that says, this is what we've found, this is what we've heard. If we are going to try to look at approaching things differently, here are some of the things that we've heard could be an approach to it.
What's motivated you to focus on mobility through places, or as I've seen you call it, the space in between?
Yeah, so when we were going through the information for the survey, we realized not a lot of Māori women had actually answered the survey. So we said, this is interesting. Is this the type of, do people feel comfortable answering the survey? You know, where has this been put out for people to feel like, yes, this is a survey for me? We looked at that, and then, as I said, we started having conversations with people, and they said, you know what? I'll tell you, when I was in the train station, when I see a security guard, that actually makes me feel unsafe. And that's an interesting perspective. I would have never thought of that. We started looking at safety and realizing that safety is so often couched as physical safety, and there are so many other elements to safety. And then, you know, when it comes to safety and belonging, those two are so intrinsically intertwined that it just seemed like no one is truly looking at that. That it's great to have sidewalk, but if someone doesn't feel like they actually belong in a space, you know, the stress of moving through that space can be a bit different. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about that space in between, it's how do you actually feel once you leave your home? How do you feel? You know, do you feel like you actually belong in that space? Do you feel like it's been planned with you in mind? Do you see yourself as you're going through your day? And starting to realize, wow, this is really like, it's been truly all of the tools that we have as planners are really in a Western framework. And what if, just what if, we were to look at it a bit differently? How do we take a step back and start to actually take note and take heed of the land that we're actually on? You know, because the wisdom is older than we are, and how can we start to incorporate that and not just dismiss it for this framework that we've been working in all along?
I think the feeling, a sense of being, is really important and definitely overlooked when it comes to traditional colonial-esque urban design. Do you have any examples personally in which you could see the sense of being flourishing under Indigenous guidance?
Just one example that was brought up to us was, you know, it would be great to see, you know, someone with a moko in your everyday, and it's maybe music. Music was another thing that was brought up to us, whereas some people might see it as noise pollution. Other people might see it as, it actually makes me feel at home. It actually makes me feel like, yeah, this is my space. So I think it's really learning to plan for the area that you're in, and I think really moving away from our systems that we're planning in a way that puts something down in front of someone and says, hey, this is what we plan to do, give us your feedback. I think we really have to start to ask the people that live there, where is it that you want to go, what is it that you want to do, what do you want the space to look like, and we'll partner with you to create the vision that you're looking for. I think that's what we're kind of hoping to influence in a way where you can plan like that, to do it like that, because asking people for feedback after you've already designed it is kind of, it's not a good, that's not a partnership at all.
Mm. It'll be really nice to see once the conversations that you'll be having digitized, I suppose, and then future urban planners and designers can go back and reference that.
Yeah, and that's essentially what we're trying to do, is create something that is just a piece, a reference piece, to say, you know, here are some folks that we talk to. And what we're really trying to do is mix up the diversity of thoughts within the folks that we're having conversations with. So we're going to have conversations with Wahine Māori. We're going to have conversations with Kotiro Māori. And then we're also going to see if we can speak to street whānau. So we want to see if we have that diversity of thought, because someone that is actually living on the street or unhoused is going to have a way different sense of belonging to someone that is housed.
That was Sophia speaking to Tiffany Robinson, Senior Transport Planner at ARUP. And you can head to Women in Urbanism Aotearoa's website if you're keen to participate in their Women's Experience in Cities survey.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
Wedged between a City Rail office and an abandoned building is a netball-sized green sanctuary, otherwise known as OMG, the Organic Market Garden Farm. Charity organisation For the Love of Bees revitalised the small block of land into a regenerative farm that provides vegetables for more than 40 families, as well as hosting bee-friendly workshops. The garden is an outlier in the way its farming benefits the soil and ecosystem, compared to Western practices, which are the leading cause of soil degradation. Sophia spoke to head farmer at OMG, Jake Clark, about the garden and its nourishment of soil and community. She started off by asking Clark about what OMG Farm is.
OMG stands for Organic Market Garden, as you said, and we are a 450 square metre market garden in the centre of Auckland at the junction between Simon Street and Mount Eden. So a highly developed area surrounded by concrete jungles. And we run a CSA model, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture. So basically, the easy way to explain it is it's a subscription. People sign up to a full season, whether it's spring, summer, autumn or winter, and come once a week to collect their produce that we harvest for them. So they don't have any say in what they get to choose. It's all seasonal vegetables that we're harvesting in that moment, so it's really quite exciting for people who are adventurous with cooking and like to explore different things. But we also sell seedlings, and we also are a compost hub as well. For the Love of Bees is trying to radically change the food system here in New Zealand, the agricultural system in New Zealand, towards regenerative practices, and OMG is the model farm that's demonstrating that.
Interesting how our main supermarkets have evolved to have the same produce at every moment of the year. And yep. This often correlates with the price fluctuations that are just beyond, right?
Yeah. And there was another thing. We sell direct to the customer, so we're not going through a supermarket or a distributor. The farmers get 100% of the money that's made through the selling of the produce. So,
do you think this is as most farm-to-table as you can get?
Other than your own backyard, then yeah, maybe. Because also one of our conditions is that you live or work within walking or biking distance of the farm, so people aren't driving to us to collect their produce. So we're trying to feed the immediate community that is in sort of the Simon Street, Mount Eden, Eden Terrace, Kingsland area.
That's really interesting. It reminds me of how we've got school district zonings.
Yes. Well, ideally, our hope is to sort of have, you know, every block we have an urban farm, or every couple of blocks we've got an urban farm. So eventually, you know, in an ideal scenario, that everyone is fed by the urban farms in their area. And I guess there's some rhetoric around how we need mass-scale, intensive industrial farms to feed the world because so many of us, but actually 80% of the Earth's population are currently fed by small-scale market gardens like this one. Mainly that's if you go to somewhere like India or China, where they have such a huge population, they still have a very large proportion of their population are still farmers. A large number of people are still fed by the small-scale market gardens.
Do you think this large supermarket chain issue is something unique to Western and colonised countries?
It seems as though it could be. Now you mention it, it seems... Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
I was just wondering about the sense of community that the in non-colonised or non-Western countries, if there is a sense of community around their farms as well, because after setting this one up back in 2018, there's been a wonderful sense of community gather around this farm to help support it, because people want to be able to access organic produce or organic seedlings. They also want there to be green spaces within the neighbourhoods. The supermarkets don't necessarily offer a sense of community.
You mentioned that the OMG started in 2018. How did this place come to be? For the listeners that might not know the garden that we're talking about, it's this immaculately green space wedged in between just urban concrete. So I'm very curious as to how this has managed to not have a building on it yet.
Yes, so the Love of Bees is a charitable trust, and it was originally set up by a group of artists, and their intention was to make Auckland one of the most bee-friendly cities on the planet. And they did that by connecting with school groups and communities to set up pollinator pathways and bee gardens. And as they ventured into the world of horticulture, organic horticulture, they understood the sort of the damage of our current agricultural practices, and the organization transitioned to focus more on food production and how do we grow bee-friendly vegetables within an urban setting. So with that being said, they were looking for land, and they found 257 Simon Street, which is where we are. That was originally, it was a building in early 2000s. It used to be a guitar shop, and that burnt down, and then it became a parking lot, and then it became a small community garden. But and City Rail Link owned the land, so they initially intended to use this site as a entryway to the underground rail network, and then slowly throughout time they realized this wasn't a good location for the rail network, and then we had the pandemic which prolonged things, and then there's just been this continuous narrative throughout the years where the date just keeps getting pushed further back. It's very unclear, but at least we know we're going to be here until 2025. Better, I think it would be fantastic if we started taking over some of the golf courses, because that's such a massive expanse of space that that's just, you know, that all of that space and all of those resources are just designated to one very small group of people, when really it should be shared collectively throughout the community.
In a country that's prolific for its farming, do you have any insight into what our soils will be like in the future, or what they are now?
So, yeah, I guess with conventional agricultural practices or industrial agricultural practices, we're often using a lot of machinery and chemicals that have been developed within the last 100 years, and a lot of it has actually come out of World War II. There's lots of fertilizers and pesticides that we're putting on our soil that were actually developed in Nazi Germany by scientists who were developing weapons for war. For that, there was the invention of the plow, and tilling and turning our soil is incredibly destructive. So when you dig and turn your soil, you're exposing the soil to the atmosphere. Carbon oxidizes and is released into the atmosphere. It also encourages the soil to dry out much quicker. But you're also killing all of the biology that's within the soil. So the fungi, the worms, the arthropods, everything that lives within the soil, that gets annihilated through ploughing and also the use of synthetic fertilizers and sides, so pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, that type of thing. Whereas the regenerative approach is ideally is to heal the soil. So we do that by polycropping, which is mixing many different species together, which sort of mirrors what nature does, is creating a diverse ecosystem. So then when we as humans intervene and plow the soil and then use chemicals on the soil, we're annihilating the fungi and the bacteria and making it harder for them to come back. Yeah, I guess oil really is a vast nebula or galaxy of many different interactions that we don't even consider or generally think about, because it just sort of exists and it's there.
That was Sophia speaking to head farmer Jake Clark of OMG Farm on Simon Street.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mō tēne wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēne rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Ni rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.